IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
This episode is brought to you by DNS Filter. With remote security top of mind, DNS Filter lets you block unknown and harmful sites from anywhere. Because it's DNS, users rave that it's the easiest security product to set up. Having started as a service provider, their goal is to be the easiest deployment for MSPs. DNS Perf recently rated DNS Filter the fastest DNS in North America. Check them out at dnsfilter.com/mspradio for a special extended trial offer.
Welcome to episode 53 of the Killing It, podcast. So we know that we're not going anywhere.
I know. We always start by talking about where we're going. Nobody in the world is going anywhere. We're all sitting at home.
Exactly. So let's skip that conversation. So what are you doing this week that you can do from your home? I know Ryan and I just recorded a podcast that
We just recorded a podcast yesterday. It was an excellent conversation. We got to go into a lot of the depth and detail on business operations in the channel that I think everybody needs to be having that conversation. It's remarkable how distracted we are by certain things in the news today. Good to come back to the fundamentals. But yesterday was a busy day. I also had a great conversation on a podcast with the IATSA community. If you're not familiar with them, the IoT Security Services Association. I believe I have their acronym correct there. But it was Brian Sherman, me, Larry Walsh, and Dan Wensley. We got together and had a conversation about what's up in the world today and where do we think it's going. I believe that's going to be posting anytime now. So if you have a chance to listen to that one, very interesting conversation.
There's something going on, Ryan. I wasn't tracking any of it.
What's happening out there in the world?
I know.
And Dave and I both have machines that have to be fed every single week.
Oh, the content machine. Of course, I'm still doing the Business of Tech podcast. For those that are not listening, I do a roundup of tech news now, right now, the top of the show, just to give you the quick tech headlines. And then now as things are starting to move forward, I'm diving into some of the data that's coming out and some of that. Later today, I will be a guest appearing on one of Channel Pro's weekly podcasts. So I'm a guest host on that. And of course, we're doing Killing It today. So today's a three podcast day. By this time it'll be already done. I'm doing a live stream tomorrow just to talk some of the insights that I'm seeing on those pieces, as well as continuing to do all of the other planning and such like that. I have a business that it always intended to be work from home, so this is operation as normal.
Yes. So and of course I do a weekly video on standard operating procedures and try to get some blog posts out. I think I've actually been notching up my blog posts to like four or five a week. Sometimes. So it's not that I'm bored. Don't get me wrong.
They say that content is king, right? I think the one thing we're starting to see as a positive side effect of all the disruption is that a lot of people got a lot of time to put their thoughts on paper. And some of them are excellent. Absolutely.
Some of them are excellent.
I don't know how excellent mine are, but I just released a book that's going to show up on the Kindle devices on April 15th on how to create a business plan and a marketing plan going forward. And then I've got another book that's in proofreading right now. And I've got a third one that should be out probably by the end of April.
Putting all of us content creators to shame. When Carl had some free time, he wrote a book.
Yeah, Carl writes like extra books when he has free time.
Some of us are on the weekend, so I wrote a book.
I did. My big achievement, I did an extra studio tour video. Nice for shaming me there, Carl.
And then you and Shaz have your videos.
We do. We have a fun series called Tipsy Treats, and we did a video on how to host a virtual party based on our experiences doing them, as well as a video that everyone should watch that we call our How to Be a Good Guest at a Virtual Party.
Yes.
Which translates very nicely.
I will repost those links in the show notes because I really love the whole virtual party thing. I think that's everything.
And that translates out of the party and into the your everyday job for all of y'all that are new to the world of logging on to a Zoom meeting and not having a bright window right behind your head, et cetera. we thought that the world knew how to do that stuff. Evidently, not so much.
Well, or walking around your apartment or whatever. So we should do a show.
We should do a show. So we're going to dive in on, we've got three topics today. The first one, we actually wanted to take a quick moment and highlight some of the winners that we're seeing from a positioning messaging perspective. Obviously things are a little crazy right now and everyone is trying to figure out what is right. I think it would be useful to hold up a couple of examples of things that are impressing us. Carl, I know you had one that, you know, you dove in and said, like, this is something that's impressing me, their moves right now.
Yeah. So from an unexpected front, there are folks on PayPal. Some of us do our credit card processing through PayPal, and they have a system where if you have enough credit card processing, they will actually give you a loan based on the amount of transactions that you had in the last year. So, you know, I don't know what the exact formula is, but you could theoretically get a $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 loan and you pay it back by just basically donating 30% of every sale to pay that back. So it's pretty safe for them. Well, what they've done in this crisis is just sent out a note to everybody on PayPal and say, hey, if you've got one of these loans, we're going to suspend payments for the next 90 days. Now, that's not something you had to apply for or click a box or ask for. They're just doing it. So you can still continue to make payments. You're not forbidden from making payments. But if it's hurting you to have that 20 or 30% go out of every sale, they've actually relieved the pressure for 90 days, which is huge because 90 days may just be enough.
Right. That is a huge difference. So I had a couple of ones. So I'll start off with giving a shout out to BMW. So I drive a BMW. It was my indulgence in terms of it. And I have a lease. And I'm just more like, with a bit of unknown, you're looking at expenses. I called BMW and I just said, hey, what are you guys doing? And they said, oh, well, if you're at all concerned, we'll just suspend the next two payments. We'll just put them at the end of the lease term. If things work out, you'll have the cash and you can just pay it off. And if there's a problem, we'll figure it out when the lease comes in. And it was instantaneous. I didn't have to do anything. I literally just had to talk to them. And they said, just do this. There's no impact to it. And I was really impressed by just how straightforward that was, how easy it was to implement. And then the other two that have really jumped out at me is messaging, is thoughtful messaging. I've seen a lot of people sort of saying, hey, now's the time to market, now's the time to market. And I don't disagree with that idea, but I think the ones that win are the ones that find the right tone. And I've been impressed by two different campaigns. They're consumer ones, but I think they set the tone. The first was, I was really impressed by Nike putting out their in this, I think they call it Stay Together at Home. And they had a bunch of athletes put it all out that their idea was that, you know, you can be part of a team by being independent. And I thought that was a really good one. And Coca-Cola just put out a really clever ad where they said, we're all in this together. And they spaced out each of the letters of the Coca-Cola ad. And there was spacing to separate each of the letters. And I just looked and I said, like, that's just really smart way of thinking about messaging so that it's relevant, it's helpful, it's at some level positive. I thought that those are the, so I don't disagree with the sentiment of, like, you want to communicate with your customers, you want to do it, but I think that there's an importance to understanding tone. And I wanted to hold up some examples of ones I was impressed by.
See, I'll totally take that to the next level at a practical application for our audience, right? They say that the steady voice amidst chaos is what gets us through difficult times. All times are difficult, right? Like, there's at any given point in time, if you look at the industrial segments of our economy, all the different standard classification codes that we deal with out there, at any given time, 10% of all SIC codes are in recession all the time, right? Like, there are going to be sectors that go up and there are going to be sectors that go down. there is always a challenge out there, and there is always an opportunity to do it well. And it is remarkable how effective proper tone can come through, right? Like, to take this to, I remember back in school, right, going through my major in communications and marketing, I was learning how to communicate compelling and persuasive messages to mass and individual audiences. And the assignment that we were given was not, you know, pick the coolest product in the entire world and make the coolest advertising that you can possibly imagine. We were given an assignment that was distinctively focused on the least interesting product that you could possibly imagine. And your job was to make it interesting anyway, right? Your job was to say, you don't have the benefit of the buzz. You don't have the benefit of all the good news associated with your product. You, as the communicator, have to do the job to make it interesting and to make it resonate with your audience. I learned a very important lesson way back then, and I've been observing, mostly critically, how poorly people do that in marketing around the world. The one that I will point out now that's doing it well, commercial starts. It's a woman standing at the drive-thru inside of a Burger King restaurant. And her dialogue starts, you know, you're probably not thinking about Burger King right now, but we are thinking about you, dot, dot, dot. And it goes through and, you know, they have a whole call to action and some things that I think operationally commendably they are doing well. She couldn't have been more correct. I absolutely positively was not thinking about Burger King. I would never have been thinking about them except that their advertising cut through the noise, struck an appropriate tone, and absolutely made a compelling point that will A, drive sales in the short term, and B, have a fantastic aura effect on them for the next several quarters. If you say Burger King to me in the next 9 months, what my brain will remember is those are the guys who did it well, mm-hmm. right? We watch advertising, we consume media every single day, and so much advertising is trash. And I am always frustrated by, like, you could have done better. Like, there's so many examples out there of not the coolest product that could be marketed well. You have an opportunity to be that person in our economy, in our industry, in the channel right now. Tone matters. Don't be a vulture. Don't like, you know, like profiteer off of this stuff, but strike the tone, be a steady voice. And remember, like, if you don't believe that now is an appropriate time to market your stuff because you're not quite sure whether your stuff is important, that's not a marketing problem that you have. that's a fundamental, what you sell ain't important. You should probably figure that out.
But I also like your point about being a steady voice is super important. And then the other thing about it is recognize that from my perspective, look, I was alluding to the fact that time is a little compressed right now. Things are moving very fast. And so everyone's inclination is to always, I must get my message into this right this second. You don't necessarily have to participate in every single moment of every single conversation. You right. want to make sure that your message is still timely, delivered well with the right tone. You can be careful and strategic about when those messages get out, and those voices will last over time.
It's always the case that the true, they always say, you know, the true judge of character is not every day when everything is normal and everything's happy and everybody's got a bunch of money, right?
Right.
The true judge of character is when things are going in the wrong direction, who is standing up and doing the right thing? And there are companies who are actually doing that. And I think it will serve them all well 5-10 years from now when people look back.
Exactly.
They will not have the YouTube video that lives forever saying what a bunch of a-holes they were.
Yeah, see, and don't forget, what we do for a living actually matters right now, right? Mm-hmm. Like technology, and God bless all the managed service providers who are keeping client networks up and running, who are educating customers about how to have an actual remote meeting and workforce in a secure way, and maintaining all of these systems and connectivity. right? Like it does not escape notice that when the entire world said, you must work from home, and we all went, I mean, okay, but that's gonna require a change to my schedule. Yet you notice what we didn't say. We didn't say, well, that's not physically possible because we don't have connectivity. Because we do. Like this stuff actually matters. So you are in the heart of the question, and you should have an opportunity to market positively.
Yeah, exactly.
And good news is we didn't get to all of our examples. So next topic.
Next topic. So this steers into almost regular news topic, and I'm looking forward to the intellectual exercise of something kind of normal, because it's still intensely relevant, but I think the problem is not specific to what we're dealing with right now. So, Carl, you were reading an article around Uber's big data in the city of Los Angeles. Want to tell us a little more about that?
Yeah. So Uber has, you know, these little scooters, obviously, right? And the city of Los Angeles wants the data of where their scooters are and where they go and when they get dropped off and you know, kind of, they want to map that all out, and they want Uber to give them the data. And Uber's like, no. You, what makes you think you have a right to that data, right? So this is, and part of it, it's an acknowledgement. This is a big data question, which we always love big data, right? But it's also a question of where do you draw that line? Because the city might say, hey, legitimately, we need to know if people are out and about and gathering in groups larger than 10 that are closer than 6 feet, and this is going to help us do that. And Uber's like, tough, right? Well, that we still have a constitution, right? You don't get to have this data just because you want it.
Right. And that is, I mean, ultimately, we have to point out that is also their business model, right? Is that they use data effectively. The not everyone just gets to have it because for any old reasons.
It's their biggest asset.
Right, exactly. And they leverage it effectively. That is how they deliver the service that they're doing. It's an interesting problem. I'm going to throw out another piece of data. In Singapore, they have released the application that they're using to track transmission of the coronavirus, but they've released it open source. And their statement is we think this is a valuable tool. We actually know that there are privacy concerns. And so the best way to deal with that is to make the code open source and allow the community to, you know, and security researchers and all of the bits that go along with open source to dig into it. That's a different approach, different view of the big data problem. They're coming at it from the privacy perspective. I think Uber appropriately is looking and saying, like, hey, this is our asset. This is the value of it. And you can't necessarily just have it because you want it.
And as we have observed before, right, there are different approaches to data and privacy here and there. There are authoritarian environments. There are open democratic environments. There are going to be efficiencies and inefficiencies on both sides of that puzzle. To take this one to its logical other end of the spectrum, Taiwan has had surprisingly low incidence of the virus compared to mainland China, compared to other areas around the world. They have had surprisingly low incidence because they are nationalizing cell phone data tracking and location information, and they are following where you go, and they're using that as in Singapore and Korea. They're being able to identify, like, if you test positive, they can go back and remap where you've been and instantly do the contact tracing and send a notice to other people. Well, the other end of this spectrum is the story that I was reading about a guy who, in Taiwan, and his phone died, right? They're online every minute of the day. His phone died. It just went offline. He didn't have a chance to charge it. Evidently, when he turned it back on, within 2 hours, somebody from the government had called him back to see, are you okay? Are you really online? Where are you at? We need to know your location. They'd called again at the 3 hour mark, and at the 4 hour mark, somebody was knocking on his door saying, are you okay? What are you doing? Now, that's efficient. But I don't think anybody listening to this podcast is going to say, hey, we should totally turn over Uber data and the Verizon data. And all. I don't think any of us are going to go to that end of efficiency.
Right. But it makes you wonder.
It requires a business plan.
That kid in Seattle who created the website based on public data, I mean, it is absolutely the case that Google has even better data than that, right? Yeah. If you have an Android, and Apple has even better data than that if you have an iPhone, right? They, all they got to do is flip a button and they could be looking at all of that. The question is, how do you do that in a way that's not intrusive?
Right. And I think that
is... Anonymized data is one thing, but being able to, you know, how the in epidemiology, they always say, well, you can't have a cell smaller than X, right? Because if you know how many people fit this profile within this many square feet, you can figure out that one guy and figure out what his identity is.
I mean, right? I'm going to fall back on the contract for the web discussion because I think that gives us a good framework for thinking about it. You know, one of the some of the principles around that is the ability for end users to have control over their data. I think that's the, for me, that's a good portion of where I think this needs to go as a general broad conversation. We have principles around this, like, now, in fact, if you think about us as a sort of democratic, small d democratic society, we have principles of privacy that in times of emergency can be suspended, but we have a legal process for that. That's what warrants are for. That's what executive orders are for. I mean, it's all playing out in real time. But by having that framework and making that some of the rights of the individual user to know about that, even in circumstances where you have to have imposed on it, being aware of its use is a critical bit. Is I know it's being used now for this public health reason, and I have insight into where it's being used and how it's being used. That actually empowers me a lot.
So here's an intellectual question.
Okay.
Should there be a website where I could check a box and say, I give up my right to privacy with regard to the following data? Like, I don't want to give you my social security number, but I will happily give you my location, even my HIPAA data. Like the fact that, you know, I have RA and I take a certain medicine, I honest to God don't care who knows that.
The answer and the approach that the European Union has taken to that and that other nations have taken to that is GDPR, right? Like, as an individual, you should be able to manage your position into all resources in the world. It's not, I got to go to 1,000 websites and re-sign up or not sign up or whatever. It allows me at a centralized approach location to say, I have my data, I have my profile. I can choose what I will disclose, what I will not disclose, and the situations or the context in which I will disclose those things, commercial, public safety, public health, et cetera, right? Like, yes, we should absolutely have that kind of a central resource. And this will make it very tangible, right? The one thing we know for sure is that these companies that built a business on data are not doing it for fun. They're not doing it for just for giggles. They're doing it for profit. And just last night, an article came out, said forecast based on all the disruption in the economy right now, just between Facebook and Google, the forecast is that in 2020, those two, just two of them, will lose $44 billion in click-based ad revenue. Now, they're not going to just like say, well, you know, nice try, let's come back next year. They're going to adapt their business model approach to recoup that $44 billion, and they will aggressively be deploying things that 6 months ago we might have thought, well, that's kind of like a spastic exaggeration of what's real and what they might do. They're going to be trying these things. And so my advice to every local participant in this industry, you need to be paying attention to privacy. You need to understand what the implications are for you, for your employees, for your clients, and you better have a policy on paper to manage this stuff, because the, oh, we'll ask for forgiveness instead of permission type of business model approach that has been so rampant in the data-driven environments, that's coming like a wave in the second part of this year.
And admittedly, I've got the opportunity, I'll close this by saying, like, look, I think there is opportunity still here. Private markets can lead on this. There is opportunity. I mean, I'm pointing back at the Singapore move, saying, like, by open sourcing it, by going that approach, it really does. You can envision ways that gets leveraged in ways that are super positive. And I just want to challenge the technology community in general to be thinking about it in those terms. Make this a positive.
And we should revisit the contract of the web, because, you know, there's always, like, literally since day one, the internet started being super open, like way more open than it ever should have been. but we've closed it up over time. But it's, you know, it started as an open environment, and there's that balance. That conversation needs to go on forever. So
it totally does.
We shall return. In the meantime, topic three, Dave, talk to us about life after the virus.
Well, so we're in our continued efforts to be future thinkers on this. We mentioned it last week. Here is our first full segment on life after. So we want to talk about the implications of technology beyond the current environment. So we can make a couple of basic assumptions here. We're not going to talk about how long it is. We're not going to talk about those kinds of, like, how are the impact during. What we're saying is, we know at some point things will return to a new normal. I expect that life will be a little different, and we don't know we're not talking about that. But what we want to say is, okay, what are the implications beyond in that life will be a little different? Where is the technology stuff on the other side? And I think the first topic we're going to dive into here is robotics and automation. So I'm waving the magic wand. We're all, let's say, a year or two out. That seems like a nice way of envisioning it. We're a year or two out, where we're looking back and there's, the short-term crisis behind us. Where, guys, do we think robotics and automation have changed the way that they're being implemented or the new opportunities around that?
Well, I will say the first thing is we will have finally settled our bet of whether your burrito gets delivered by a drone or a robot. And Dave's always voting for the robot because drones aren't allowed to fly in his area.
Yep. Oh, totally.
but I guess the question so do Ryan and I get a pizza or a burrito delivered by robot or drone? And I think robots are going to make a huge step forward in this simply because they've been positioned in the right place for so long. Like, it's literally, they've already got the manufacturing in place. They've solved a lot of problems, and drones too. But I mean, they, basically, as people say, well, we need to have this distancing, or we need to, you know, we don't have the workforce we had. Right. Suddenly, two things are going to happen. One is robots will begin to take over the world. But second, all those people who are now looking for jobs, a lot of them are going to be employed working with robots, programming robots, fixing robots, building robots,
right,
building parts for robots. I mean, entire industries that do not exist today will come into existence in the next 2 years servicing robots. And that's a permanent change. That's a shift that will last the rest of my lifetime.
See, again, being future thinkers in this segment, what we want to make sure people understand is, you know, how long and how disruptive will these changes be? And I think Carl made the point there. It will be permanent. It's not going to be a temporary thing. And it will be a dramatic reorientation of the way we do things. But I also want to make sure we're careful on the definition of future. In this specific case, I do not believe we're talking 10 years into the Jetsons' future.
No,
we're talking right now, next quarter, as soon as business gets back going. Right now, one of the things that I've been focused on for about the last, I don't know, it's been about 15 years that I've had the opportunity to work in the business and the channel of manufacturing, engineering, automation, design, etc. Right, we have a number of clients that are mechanical engineers, electrical engineers. These people do computer-aided design. They do facilities design and warehouse automation. They do manufacturing automation. They do simulation, etc. While we have been focused on Moore's Law and obsessed with the progress of silicon-based technology, they have been equally obsessed with operational technology. And this stuff is there. It is impressive, it is capable, and it is coming to a shop near you. Now, I had an opportunity last year. We went on a client facility tour, right? One of the most interesting things that we do in our job, usually on the IT side of the house, when we take these tours, it's touring people's data centers, right? And I've learned to be fascinated by all the blinking lights and cord and cable management out the back end of the data center, right? In this case, it was operational technology, and the facility was a metal bending manufacturing shop that was producing goods as a supply chain contributor in the automotive industry, right? They build door panels for big auto manufacturers. You've seen the movies, you've seen robotic welding, and you've seen all these, you know, things that look like, oh, wow, that's a multi-million dollar machine. And of course, the big ones have that. This was a company with fewer than 50 employees that had less than $15 million in total annual revenue. And the degree to which they were using robotics and automation made my little nerd heart just skip a beat. Oh, holy cow, it was impressive. That stuff is here and it's coming, right? I don't want anybody in the IT world to think, well, you know, we're at the cutting edge of technology, so once the automation catches up, we'll figure it out. Oh no. If you're not already thinking robots and automation and how you, Mr. Technology Service Provider, will monitor, manage, and operate those robots inside of a network operating system with an RMA relay. Your job description needs to also be thinking not just IT, but OT. And if you're not already familiar with that concept, you need to feel a proper sense of urgency right now because the world is automating.
Right. And I can think of very specific examples which are going to be exploring really quickly. The supply chain in most of areas, but even creative areas like grocery stores are now going to be thinking about robots. Why? Because it's difficult right now to restock when you've got, you know, when you have workers that may be getting sick and you need to be able to do that on a continual rapid basis. I think we're going to see it in grocery stores. I think we're going to see it in restaurants. I think we're going to see it in retail. I think we're going to see delivery is something that we're already seeing it. We're seeing a lot of pivot there. There's going to be a lot of thinking by small local retailers of how do I make myself more friendly for that, you know, more compatible. Even if you're still a local business, a little shop that sells things or a restaurant, you're going to figure out like, I want to make sure that I'm ready to do delivery easier. There's a pickup, there's automation to that. Like there's a bunch of areas where I think we're going to see rapid change because everyone's going to say, I want to prepare for this. Oh, and by the way, it has other benefits too, to help me do my business in all kinds of bad situations.
And I will give one final prediction, which is this transition in the next couple of years is actually going to reverse a lot of the negativity some people feel towards robots. I think that when we come out of this, people are going to say, I got a job because of the robotics industry, instead of saying, I fear that I will lose my job to the robotics industry. But mm-hmm. So far, what little history we have, robots haven't actually taken people's jobs. They have changed their jobs to other things. But I think that will be maybe not complete, but we will be well on our way to robots being the source of new jobs. And that is part of the economy that will emerge.
Well, and you're right. Every disruptive new technology begins with fear. Like, oh, it's going to take away my job. When the internet came out, the first reaction to it was, you've got access to my private information. You can watch me everywhere and watch porn. Like that was all people thought that it was for. And then later on, the use cases came along and we went, oh, wait, that's actually a really productive tool. It's a good thing. Let's lean in. robots scary, going to take my job. Wait a minute. They enable us to do things we literally could never have done. That's a good thing. Let's examine the use cases. I did this last week, I think, and I want to kind of finish with it here. There, I'll give everybody a homework reading assignment again, right? I read a book years ago that is specifically applicable to this situation. It's a book called A Whole New Mind, written by a guy named Daniel Pink. And he's written a number of books since then. I think he's a super smart guy. But his whole concept was in this book, the world of automation, outsourcing, offshoring, everything, it is coming and it is here and it will disrupt your job. What are the skills and the job capabilities that will actually sustain us, right? If a machine can do your job, what can a machine not do that a human needs to do? And he outlines six different capabilities that machines will never have, that we must supply, that are not only going to be good for job opportunities, but they're going to be absolutely mandatory for the operation of our society. He talks about things like design and aesthetics, about story and surprise. He talks about empathy and about play and fun. These are things that robots do not know, they cannot do, and we need to be able to supply those things. A Whole New Mind by Daniel Pink. Read this book.
Also a great audiobook
of robots.
Ah, good audiobook too.
Yep.
And we know you podcasters like listening to things. Podcasters, consumers. Well, exactly. we are out of time. And so we appreciate everybody taking the time to listen to us. Please give us some feedback. We're actually, in this area, I am super interested in hearing other people's thoughts on which of these technologies on the other side. Like when you project out and think about where we're going, I'd love to hear the ones that other people are tracking right now. I think this is some of the conversation is technologists that we want to think about the implications on the other side.
Very good. And that will do it for the 53rd episode of the Killing It Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.